the narrative.
Hey everybody, welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host. I'm joined tonight by Adam Camilleri.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
And Red Powell.
Hello.
We are the Bell Lost Souls podcast. Thanks for joining me, guys.
Man, happy to be here again. And exciting last little bit of context has been dropped on us.
This is the What's the Point episode. In the middle of this episode, I actually have a segment with Duncan Rhodes, where we talk a little bit about his hobby, what he's doing now with his professional endeavors, and then how to kind of get started in an army if you're picking up something brand new.
Man, FTN going from strength to strength here. Dan Abnett 1 week, Duncan Rhodes next week. Like, where do you go from here, though?
Strap in. I don't want to give it all away. I don't want to jinx it, but we got some good stuff in the can.
Slick.
Yes. Speaking of what's the point, we're going to go through a few lists. Red and Adam, I think you both have built some lists for us to talk about. And I guess you did it with 8th edition points. And then we'll do a little bit of analysis of what it goes to in 9th edition. And with this, I think by the time this comes out, everyone will have seen the points from the other content creators. There's a general increase in things. And some armies, I think, came out a little bit better on that increase level right now. And, you know, I've got some thoughts on what that means or what the designers are maybe trying to do. But I think that the best way to talk about it is just kind of getting our hands on it and talk about some units and what they do.
Well, there's enough parallels between what's the changes that you can kind of draw some conclusions. I mean, this is speculation, of course, but you can draw some reasonable conclusions about how G-Dub thinks the game's going to be played and where they think the power is. And from what I can tell, they seem pretty spot on. I think some things have gotten the hit with the points stick a bit. You know, some people have been pushed out of the points tree and hit every points branch on the way down. But so some other armies, they seem quite reasonable. Yeah, exactly. Literally Eldari. Whereas Custodes, they just walked past the points tree. They were just like, oh, that's a nice tree.
Yeah, I actually got someone broke it down really well with the Custodes across the board on aggregate, looking at, you know, like a 2.6% change, roughly. And then at the very bottom, the worst of the worst, unfortunately, with some point increases, looking at approximately like 24% increase. That's another army that we can talk about later.
Wow, man. Well, Custodes, I mean, arguably seem to have done all right going from this edition to the next, because, you know, with Psychic Awakening coming out and giving them a big boost, with the table shrinking, better terrain rules, points staying about the same.
Yeah. Obsec across the board for their whole army list if you're a mono faction. Like, they've got a lot of things going for them.
Well, look, to any budding Custodes player out there, the Retributor armor can of spray paint is expensive, but it's worth it. I just don't care. It's worth it. Just put it out there. And maybe experiment with shading with purple. I hear that's really good on gold. You wouldn't believe it, but that's what they tell me.
And greens. Contrast the purple with some green for the older boys. That's a tip my mate gave me. If you shade with the purple and you glaze with a little bit of green, a bit of spot colors, because it gives that real old gold feel.
There it is. Look, we just got the episode done in 3 minutes. Play Custodes.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. We did every segment. We touched on the points. We did the hobby segment. Like, we're out. This is it.
Wonderful show, guys. Thank you.
No worries. See you next week.
So, anyway, we built some lists. Red, let's kick off with you. You've built, I think, at least one Necron list, maybe an older school Necron list, but
yep.
Let's hear some of your choices.
Okay, so the older Necron list, and I'm sitting here looking at what, you know, has been compiled. The community was really on it today as far as compiling these adjustments. And so this, you know, so some of this is no longer going into 9th edition. There are ways to achieve this, but not in the same way. So for example, the first thing in my Necron list is an air wing detachment with doom sights. Those three doom sights were a pretty staple deal there at the end of the Necron meta, as far as kind of what you could expect to see because of that amalgamated targeting data stratagem they had that could just nuke, you know, like Tau castles, man, and stuff.
I got dang near eliminated by that one time. And the dude was like, hey, man, do you know what my stuff does? I said, yeah, of course, man. I know what Necrons are. Thinking I was going to just walk through it like a lazy Sunday afternoon.
Right. Yeah. Well, so all of those, they went from 150 points to 170 points. So that's 60 extra points right there. So the next part was a battalion of Sawtech, which had the Stormlord, a Cryptek, and a Lord, 30 Immortals, and then a squad of Tombblades. And so this is all Tesla, right? This is back when Necrons were really playing on this Tesla trick to be able to plus up. Now this isn't going to be a thing anymore to a certain extent. So I think we're going to see gauze blasters coming into play more so than a mass of Tesla carbines, because we can't get the, you know, no longer can you get more than plus one to hit. So it's not where you used to be able to stack and get plus, you know, plus two to hit, and in some cases even, you know, very rare. But you're talking about Tesla that was able to proc on, you know, fours essentially, which was awesome. But besides that, I mean, so now the immortal,
that's like a weird casualty of the situation. I hadn't even thought about that, but that could be a big deal.
Well, and again, it, you know, to a point, with the way that the meta has gone, it's not too big of a deal because AP and everything like that, like you're going to want more gauze as well. But yeah, that is, it was kind of a, that's something that's definitely going to change the meta for Necron players to a point. But so going to the immortals, I mean, so it's a little deceiving in that immortals used to be 15 points a model. I think I've got it right, but that's 8 points the model, and then it was 7 points for the weapon. But what they did, and you see this kind of going through a lot of the other armies as well, is they've removed the gun cost. The weapon cost is zero now, and then they increased the model to 18. And so it went from 8 points to 18 points. But again, that's including the weapon now. So they kind of made up for it there. So in reality, it was only a 3-point increase. The problem being is this list has 30 immortals to it. So that 3-point increase per model is now a 90-point increase. So kind of a intense increase on the immortals. Also, given their 18 points versus a Primaris who's 20 points. And so I know we're waiting on the Necron Codex to see what gets updated for reanimation protocols. And I'll just leave it at that I'm very excited to see what new reanimation protocols looks like.
We don't know anything about it, but what do you think may be a change?
Well, I think, you know, talking to some folks, I think that GW is in, you know, we always want to believe that GW has the best interests in the game as a whole. And so, and I do truly believe that. And I think that they looked at reanimation protocols and realized that in 8th edition, you could kind of circumvent it. All you really had to do was see it play itself out once, and you kind of figured it out. And so I think they're going to do something that makes it a little more durable, I think, at the same time and in a fair trade. So it used to be that I would just roll a reanimation protocol per model. So like my destroyers, which were 3 wounds apiece, I could just roll once and I'd bring back the entire destroyer with all 3 wounds. I wouldn't be surprised, I guess, if they did something to kind of mediate that to a point. But I do think that they're going to do something that makes the whole process a little more durable for the Necron player.
Gotcha. We'll see how it all plays out, because I think we can expect something on Necrons pretty soon. They got a ton of new units. And one of the interesting things about this is that we know there's a Void Dragon shard and a Silent King coming, and there's no points for that in the book.
That's right. That's right.
Not that they say that they couldn't include that in the data slate that comes with the model, but mm-hmm. I think that just leads me to believe we've got some impending Necron goodness coming over and above what we've seen already.
I think there's an assumption that Necrons might be the first or one of the first in a bundle of new codexes. And I mean, they certainly deserve it. I think their codex has been not maligned, but it's certainly jumped off the power end of the pier and not floated too well. But I think there's almost an accepted assumption that's what's going down.
Yeah, I mean, and you kind of think with the new models, they're flashing out there that's it's going to be, we'll say it's imminent, right? We think that it's very imminent.
Well, it's almost a doubling in the range. Just from that one single picture, you're like, okay, they had like 11 things in their range. They looks like they've got about 20 things in their range now, not counting like little characters like the Wardens and the, you know, elite slot characters and stuff like that. But so I'd assume if they're going to double the range, you should probably put them all in a codex. Otherwise, I'd hate to feel like we've got to buy 3 more books to get all the rules for new models and stuff to play a Necron army now.
Hey, I'm sure they'll be there. Yeah.
Red, you mentioned that stratagem that you need 3 of the Doomsites together. Well, there aren't any detachments that have 3 flyer slots.
That's right. You're gonna need 2 to at least get that through.
So there's a flyer slot in the Outrider, and there's 2 in a Battalion. Is that correct?
They all have 2. Everything has 2.
Everything has 2. Up to 2.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, not everything. The ones that have flyer slots have up to 2 flyer slots.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, yeah. Do you think it's worth it stringing out into multiple detachments? Because we've been talking about that you can basically get everything done in one detachment to make the most out of the free CPs that we feel like we have right now.
Right. I mean, is it worth it to an extent? I think that it is. I don't see why not. That was such a good stratagem. The next part being when we talk about the codex, and you know, you kind of hit on it, Paul, with the unintended casualties or the collateral damage of the new stuff. We can't even say that that stratagem even exists in the new codex necessarily. And so
the kill shot.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it could happen. And so I'm not going to discount it just yet, because obviously we're not losing the codex yet. But I think that you bring up a very good point in regards to the detachment itself. Yeah. Yeah.
I think there's a lot more interesting. I feel like list construction is a lot more interesting now. There's a lot more give and take. Used to be just take. I pay more points, fill out more slots, I take more command points. And now you got to give and take. You got to give up command points, take more slots. I like this equation a lot better.
I think it's maybe difficult to think about how we felt when we had Index 40K.
Right.
But we're at that stage right now to where how we build a list is changing. And I think that's going to be kind of a bitter pill to swallow right now, maybe, but it was at the time as well.
Right. Well, and also understanding, yeah, I've seen some great products that people are making that not changing anything, but just in how they're presenting the new format of even, and these are just the core rule books and the missions and how to track and keep score and everything. And the missions are very interesting in how you go into it, right? Because when we go into list building, I mean, outside of our lore specific goals or whatnot that we want to accomplish, you're really looking at, and Adam, you talked about this before, you want to achieve a certain effect, right? You're focused on achieving something. And I don't think that missions necessarily are nearly, and not in a bad way. I'm not saying this bad by any means, but, and Paul, I think you talked about it last time in regards that movement is such a big part of the game going forward that I really do think board control has a lot more than necessarily just killing people. And I think Necrons are going to have something that they didn't necessarily have beforehand in the regards of being able to persist, to endure and hang on the field and, you know, execute board control, really.
That board control element is I think huge, and I think it's huge and resonates with the designers themselves as well. What we've seen is that if you can stand on the board and do something that like a Gretchen is in effect sometimes the same effectiveness as a guardsman.
Right.
And then that point cost is not going to be no lower than 5 points as we stand right now.
That's right. That's right.
Because even the humble Gretchen, the humble Grot is now 5 points per model, yeah?
Yeah,
5 points. Yes. Like a cultist and like a guardsman. Yeah.
Percentage wise, that's almost double.
Yeah.
What it was before. So the orcs, I mean, I don't know if we'll talk. What is up with the Ruck-a-Truck squig buggy is being 10 points more expensive? I'm not trying to sidetrack us from the Necron talk. I'm just saying, you never saw one of those in the first place. So giving it a point increase seems a little bizarre to me. But that we're in that awkward that awkward change between, you know, what we thought 3 days ago as opposed to what we have right now. And if we did, like, if there's any comfort we can take, is that this is the exact same way that we felt between every single edition that's ever happened.
That's right.
There's always this predictable period of hyperbolic, not panic, just more, I don't know, people not quite being willing to see things or divest themselves or let go from what was. And just accept what is now.
It's a paradigm shift, right? And in that paradigm shift, I mean, you're taking everything that you've done, like, you know, you mentioned the index of 8th edition. I mean, I started with Necrons at the you know, ATC that was the first major event of 8th edition, and to see where they're at now, like that is just there's a paradigm shift that everybody, if you're going to keep playing the game, you kind of got to get on board with, or you know, just keep playing 8th edition, I guess. But it's definitely a paradigm shift for the player in seeing the points are just, in certain regards, the points are just a different version of terrain, and you've got to learn how to adapt and overcome.
That's a very fair point. And I also don't want to make it seem like I agree with all the points changes. I think that some of them, like I just mentioned about that, you know, the Ruck-a-Truck squig buggy, because it's fun to say. I'm probably going to say it as much and often as possible. Actually, one of my New Year's resolutions was to work in as often as possible to say what the Babu freak is going on here. I didn't do that as much. So here we go. I just got it in What? But you get what I'm saying. The Wreck-A-Truck Squig Buggy, which is something that hasn't even been on the table, is now even less incentivized to get on the table. So I don't agree with all the changes. And I think that there are some, I don't want to say like stealth nerfs, because there's no stealth about it. It's a published, going to be published points. But there's a way to curtail some of the things that have real beneficial abilities, real beneficial stats, real beneficial stratagems you can throw on them. And we've seen that play out in some of the points. And I think that may be why some of the Eldari are hit so much. And then Centurion certainly seem like they've gotten a little bit curtailed. Mm-hmm. I know I'm jumping around, but that's I want to get out these concerns as early in the show as possible to show that we're all going through that process right now. Mm.
There's been a little bit of a soapbox I've been meaning to get on for a long time regarding balance of Games Workshop, and I've dropped little tidbits of this opinion in throughout years, and it's finally coalescing based on what I've seen, the reactions to points and things. I want someone in the comments to tell me of another game that exists, another game system that exists, the modes that it does, as in it's got an online presence, it's got an offline presence, it's got a physical presence, it's got shop fronts, it's got all this stuff, and that has literally hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of models that have like 3 or 4 or 5, 10 different options each, weapons-wise, loadouts-wise, equipment-wise. And just try and get your head around, this is possibly the hardest game in existence to balance. I can't think of another game that has this many options, this much depth, this many codexes, factions, books, different ways to play things, different things and interactions, warlord traits, stratagems, terrain, so many levels and depth. And this is just it's the biggest onion in the world to try and get your head around and balance effectively. And let's not crap on them for trying, you know?
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot to it.
Yeah.
No, I think part of us crave that kind of ebb and flow of things and balance a little bit too.
But literally, someone challenged that thought, is there a game out there that would be more challenging to balance than this one? And if there isn't, why do we hold these guys and say, oh, why can't they balance it like X game or Y game or whatnot? You know, I mean, Magic the Gathering literally has to phase out models every 3 months. So cards every X, Y, Z months to keep their game progressing. Do we want that in 40K? No, no one wants that in 40K because our models cost too much and we put too much love and effort into them. Well, so yeah.
Then the challenge, chill. You're mentioning with the challenge of keeping everything balanced and current, is that those cards then rotate into their more eternal formats. So, and those are supported things in the game. And so they do have to constantly look at it. And, you know, yes, that's probably the closest analog is Magic. And that's something they struggle with over there. I mean, cards become restricted, suspended, banned, only good in XYZ formats.
Yeah.
They struggle with this.
And even then, like how many new cards come out in addition? Like how many new cards come out every 3 months? I don't feel like it's hundreds.
No, it actually is. It's probably 200 or something plus cards every
year. Oh, really? I thought every 3 months. I thought it was around 100. Never mind.
No, it's a ton. I mean, look, but some of those are reproints. Some of them are designed to introduce effects into the game.
Maybe that's what I'm talking about. Maybe it's only 100 brand new cards or so each edition. But never mind. That probably fluctuates as well. But even then, you think about how many models there are in the Chaos Space Marine range, and then how many weapons options each model can have, and then how many different Empress Children in Iron Hand, sorry, and Iron Warriors, and, you know, all those things. World Eaters, Black Legion, and how all these things can be different in these different contexts. And the same thing, same Chaos Space Marine model in like 5 different legions can do and operate in different ways and interact with different rules in different ways. It's so exponentially deep that just thinking about that and talking about it then caused me harm.
But see, I think that, again, there's something about it that we like in about that slight bit of imperfectness in things that we get to continue to talk about what is. And then we have the element of just what we want to do. And that's the coolest thing. That's again, we're at that threshold, that precipice of everything can be good right now. And then when you couple that with the fact that craving efficiency, a part of that is the points, and now we have all that to digest. Like what is efficient now? I mean, yes, we could probably file it down or sharpen it down to the very edge, but not without getting out there and doing and interacting with it.
Mm. Right. Right. Yeah. The player or the pilot or whatever you want to refer to it has huge say in regards of the efficiency in a lot of cases. And that's a very big point in the actual experience of the game itself, too.
Yeah. Look, kudos to G-Dub for taking it on. it's got to, I can't even think about what this means at an organizational level. Like, how many full-time staff do they have just dedicated to balancing the game? Probably, I mean, arguably, people are comments are going to be like, whatever Adam says, it's not enough. But that plus one. Yeah, right. I challenge anybody to put out a document that's going to get it all right with so many options and so many things going on.
Yeah, but getting it right is a bit of a moving target. I mean, so to your point.
Do we want them to get it perfectly on? If they got it perfectly on, bang, would we get bored after like 3 or 6 months if it was perfect? Like, I don't know. I feel like we would.
Well, I guess what I'm just saying is this is the opening salvo. This is the landscape of what the edition should look like right now, and we know it's going to evolve. I think we've established a pattern of this stuff evolving and having tweaks over time, so maybe everyone's blood pressure shouldn't get up because the Stompa is still 9,000 points.
So tying back to the, you know, like mentioning the Stompa, right, and some of the scaling of this and bringing this back to the Necron piece, the next unit I had were the Tomb Blades, which this is an interesting part in regards to you talk about the scaling and how different some of the stuff is. So a Necron Tomb Blade unit of 7 Tomb Blades, total of in 8th edition was 231 points. That's with all the whiz bang stuff attached. Now, some players might actually consider, so that in the new 9th edition points I've calculated, it is a 42 point increase, right? That's pretty big, going from 231 points to 273 points. That's so what I would, for Necron players, I mean, immediately looking at other options, in contrast to that. So in 8th edition, the Deceiver, who is amazing, who I would also recommend outside of these Tomb Blades, with his ability to redeploy and just being a Satan by himself and the powers that he has. You put in the Deceiver in 8th edition, the Deceiver was 180 points. Going into 9th edition, he's only 190 points. So a 10-point increase. Like, yep. I would gladly make that
5%?
Change.
That's a bargain. Yep,
it's 5.6%. That's right. Like, yeah, that's a huge bargain. I'd totally bring the Deceiver. The ability to redeploy and his powers and everything, like, yeah, I'll change him out. Now that Tomb Blade squad, you know, it definitely has a different effect and what it's supposed to be doing, but I mean, to bring that many Tomb Blades down to just make up for those points, like, that hurts a lot. That's rough. I mean, you're essentially cutting a whole nother Tomb Blade out of the squad just to two Tomb Blades to bring it down. And so it's that hurts a lot. But the next big one I want to say, so we saw this fluctuation with Necrons of going up and down from index, like we mentioned, to
they'll be back.
Chapter approved. That's sure. Right. Yeah. No, yeah. Fair point. The vehicles went down a lot in the last chapter approved. And the one previous to that. And so the vehicles slowly became like mechanized. Necron lists were on the rise. I mean, so I was running a lot of destroyers at the beginning of 8th edition. I love the destroyers, you know, just mobile infantry, big guns, pretty cool. Anyways, but the vehicles, Doomsday Arcs, right? That's the next big one. And kind of like the Doom Scythes, the Doomsday Arcs went from 160 points to 180 points. And even the Ghost Arcs. So it's like all those vehicles went up by 20 points. I still think, you know, that's only a 13% increase for Doomsday Arcs. I still think they have a lot of play. I think the Doomsday Arc stays in there regardless. I think that it's, I mean, now we haven't seen the you know, the new Walker thing, that the new Canoptic Doomsday model that they've shown us. We haven't seen what it does necessarily, but right now as it stands, I think the Doomsday Arc still makes a lot of its money still. I don't think that it's priced itself out in 9th edition.
So are you kind of happy with where Necrons are sitting? I mean, the truth will be when the new stuff comes out and how relevant, how powerful that stuff, but let's say there were no new models coming out and you were just transitioning to this edition with what you had in 8th. How are you feeling about it?
And they're kind of, so they're out of all of them, from what we've seen, they've got approximately like a 12% increase on aggregate. Yep. That list that I described, so that was 1,981 points. And then going into 9th edition, it would be an additional 230 points. I don't think that's necessarily, but given the decrease of the board, Necrons kind of had a mobility issue outside of using like Veil of Darkness and redeployment and stuff.
And on top of that, they they had a real range issue as well. Apart from Doomsday Arcs, there was nothing that really hit the back end of the board in Hammer and Anvil, did it?
You really had to move up into it. You had to expose yourself. You had to get out there. There was no Basilisk equivalent of just sitting back outside of the Doomsday Arcs. You're right. And so I don't mind going into it with the board has decreased with the turns and everything. And again, with the game shifting more to a board control element versus just a kill everything element. I think that Necrons have some pretty good play just as the rules are. I think that it's just, again, adapting to the paradigm shift of 9th edition and playing into it with the Necrons. I don't think that Necron players are necessarily playing down that much. There are some shifts for paradigm shifts for Necron players specifically, because Tesla just isn't going to do what it did before, like we discussed. You need to consider, higher AP. Gauze, strength 5, AP minus 2, that's nothing to scoff at. Turn it into Mephrit and it becomes AP minus 3 at half range. That's real good.
You think about it like this. If people are going to be more willing to drop and take out those three Doomsites out of their list, how many points did you just save there?
That's right. Yeah, exactly.
Just in army construction, the paradigm shift you were talking about, the change in thinking. If you just drop those three Doomsites, technically you're still coming out of probably about 120 points better on the change, isn't it? You're taking away the Doomsites and you're adding one more unit and bang, you're back at 2,000 points, give or take, yeah?
Exactly. You figure out the difference, and also counting all the vehicle changes. Those Doomsday Arcs, they have gauze flares, and that's 10 rapid fire shots right there. And that's just you can charge them and they have quantum shielding still, and they're pretty tough with a lot of wounds.
They got 14 wounds or something crazy.
Yeah, 14 wounds, and they heal. And they're going to be plugging those gauze flare shots
into combat. So they can shoot in combat.
Yeah, they can.
Yeah, the gauze flares are not the flare arrays. It's just like having 10 Necron warriors sitting inside of it.
Is that what it is? A gauze flare array?
They call them the flare array. Yeah,
it's zero points.
Yeah, exactly. That's awesome. Again, those vehicles are still looking really good. And having three of them, they're just going to sit there. I totally think, especially with the way the rules for vehicles are, I've run Ghost Arcs myself but I don't think that there's a wrong or bad reason to take Ghost Arcs with Necron Warriors inside of them at the moment.
See some play. Is 140 points.
Yep. 140 points.
Yeah, I don't know what all stuff like war gear you'd want to put on it or whatever, or you can put on it, but the Gauss Flare Array, it's a 0 point upgrade, as a lot of the primary weapons on vehicles are. The secondary weapons you have to pay for, and Lemur Rust turrets, I think you have to pay for.
Yeah, so the Ghost Arc, it has two of those arrays, so that's rapid fire 5. So in other words, at half distance, it's putting out 20 shots. So if you've gotten into engagement range with it, it's shooting you 20 times. And it also has 14 wounds and has quantum shield.
It's got a good movement too, right?
Yeah, it's not bad. It's flying. I think it's 10 inches. So that's nothing to scoff at for Necrons.
I don't know that you'll want to be assaulting with it, but technically the Necrons are moving to where you could conceivably make a primarily close combat army.
Obviously I've got this other list of World Eaters, so I wouldn't mind taking my melee mentality over to Necrons with these new destroyers coming out.
The Scorpec destroyers, the Lord, the Tomb Blades, Flayed Ones. This is not an endorsement of Flayed Ones. But I'm saying the Necrons previously had, you really couldn't even entertain that type of build. And now you're going to be able to, especially with Satan powers. You could have things that back up your close combat and shoot space lasers.
Well, and so, something else to go with that is Praetorians. I really feel like GW has been trying to make Praetorians work for a long time now. They've constantly gotten point reductions at this point. So it looks like they went up, they went from 63, but then like you said, in value of points and everything, when you go over to weapons, Rod of Covenants or Void Blades or War Scythes or any of those, they're all free now. And so a Triarch Praetorian by itself, it's a 2-wound infantry model and it has fly. there's nothing to joke about with these Triarch Praetorians either. I do think that there's some space and some room to consider them as well.
And I mean, like in ages gone by now, the only melee Necron armies I'd see would be spamming Wraiths and Scarabs. And they wouldn't, the Wraiths would just run up and tap as many things and wrap as many things as they could possibly do. And then they'd hope that the Wraiths had the right profile to actually kill things. Because if it was actually vehicles, Wraiths wounding on fives don't do that well against toughness seven.
That's right.
But they don't just auto explode like a lot of other Necron stuff did. So,
but Scarabs, I gotta highlight this. We're back to old Scarabs.
Yes, sixes auto wound, yeah.
You roll on a six to hit, and it auto wounds, and that's so huge. That's so huge.
So good. And on top of that, they went up a wound, I believe.
Yeah, they're four wounds, correct. Yeah,
I never understood why they were three. Every other swarm is four wounds. I never got it.
Well, what kills me is that they come as four. Like, there's four little Scarabs on the base.
But there were three wounds, yeah.
It took me a second to adapt to that one for a little bit.
I may have put three Scarabs on my buddy's bases.
Oh, that's smart. You'll have to go put more on there. You?
I know. Right? I'm gonna go.
Fix it, Paul.
I'll just pitch those right in the trash. That's funny. So, but Wraiths were a popular choice. So they're 45 points apiece now without their weapons, and they are one of the ones that I think they do have to pay for weapon upgrades.
So they don't have to pay for their melee weapons, right? Their melee weapons stayed. If they take the whip coils, they went up by 1 point. That's actually like, so from what they went from 42 to 45 is not bad at all. But then you look at, so their you do have to pay for their guns, the trans-dimensional.
Is it the whip coils are five, and then they've got, what is it called? Transmissional beamer.
Yeah. That was one of the weapon profiles, and that one is like, that's still 15 points. So that one kind of hurts. They have another one that it's a good one. I mean, if at the point, so the particle caster is,
that's the strength six.
That's 0 points,
isn't it?
So that is what that was something I was talking about to some of my Necron friends today, is that, yeah, so the particle caster's current stats, you know, not counting the new profile, it's a pistol weapon, strength six, 0 AP, 1 damage, range 12 inches. So like, there's absolutely no reason why you wouldn't give your Wraiths these particle casters.
That's neat. I wouldn't even have thought of that.
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah, and it's awesome. I'm like you said, Adam, I love to run. I was running a squad of five Wraiths, and they were purely a distraction Carnifex.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Now you're going to give me particle casters for free? Cool. Got it.
Sprinkle the cherry on top. Little bit of hundreds and thousands. I'm not sure you guys even have them over there.
Cherries? Or
hundreds and thousands. That's what we call like the little sprinkles you put on ice cream.
Oh, no. I have no idea what you're talking about.
You put them on donut.
But it sounds delicious, and we're going to go with it. With the point increases across the board, that means we're effectively shrinking the armies to 1750 or 1600 or whatever in some cases. If you play Eldari. So I think we can finally dispel the rumor that the Games Workshop is just trying to sell models.
Yeah, I mean, they are, but not just.
Not just, right?
Not just sell models.
Put some effort into your point, balancing the game. So it's, I mean, this is, again, with some of the point increases seemingly to be heavy-handed. Another one that came out pretty well is Harlequins. So I mean, and then we weren't necessarily.
They came out so well. I'm actually scared now. Their new rules. I was like, they're probably going to be good, but I'll wait till I see. I'll wait till I play them. But now I'm undoubtedly thinking that they're good. Everyone else has gone up. They've essentially stayed the same, with the exception of their Skyweavers. Their bikes. They've gone up. I believe it's 10 points per model. It's a little bit hard to get your head around, because you got to, I mean, these things will all become pretty much known quantities in like literally a week. We'll all know exactly how much points things are. But, you know, when you have to go from one page to another page to check the equipment change.
Well, you'll know what an army looks like. Like, you consider, yeah. Like, we right now, we're all very comfortable looking at somebody across the table and go, yeah, I know what an army does. I know what I can expect, what weapon options they probably took. And it's different now.
Yeah, but so apparently the Harlequin troops and the transports have essentially come out the same. Some tech choices have changed, some weapon choices and some loadouts have changed in points. But apparently in the wash, they're essentially the same points. That's really powerful, because the amount of things you can do with a Harlequin troop now exploded so much with their Psychic Awakening release.
Yes. Yeah, this is...
I'm pumped. I'm pumped for Harlequin players. Yes. I can't say the same for Craft World and Drakari, but... I can't shed a tear for Craftware players. I literally can't. It's impossible.
They've certainly enjoyed some time in the sun. They've been a dominant for 35 years now.
Yeah, it's a I need to get one Pavlov's dog reference in. It's a reverse Pavlov's dog. You know when you salivate when you see an army, you know you're just going to crush. Like my saliva dries up when I play against like expert crafters or three Crimson Hunter Exarchs. I'm just like, there is no saliva anymore. Dry mouth completely.
Well, I know we're going to touch briefly on some of the tangentially the Eldar stuff here in a second, but let's take a break. Let's come back with that segment with Duncan, and then come back with us. See you all in a minute.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey everybody, welcome to a Community Spotlight segment of Forge Narrative. My name is Paul, your host. I'm joined this afternoon by Duncan Rhodes.
Hello everybody, how you all doing?
Duncan, thanks for joining me.
Well, thanks very much. Nice to be here.
Man, so you have your own channel now. It's not completely brand new, but it's fairly recent, and you've been going into this concept of like a painting academy with your style of tutorials, man. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah. I've had quite a few changes over the last few months. Essentially, so what I've been doing, along with a friend of mine who was kind of like, I've mentioned a few times in different podcasts and things, but he's always been there in the background. The two of us have always had a bit of a dream about what it'd be like to run your own business. My friend, especially Roger, he's always kind of thought, you know, it'd be cool to be able to do your own thing, be your own boss, like that sort of stuff. And, you know, could you do it? What could it be like? And one day we sort of started talking to ourselves of like, you know, could we do this as our own thing? Because the painting tutorial stuff that we were doing took off to a degree beyond what either of us ever expected it to. And, you know, we just kind of got to the point where we were thinking, well, if we're ever going to do something like this, now's the time to do it. And we didn't want to have any regrets looking back in years time, you know, going, oh, I wish we'd have tried doing something like this. So yeah, we got up all our courage and left Games Workshop to go and do painting videos independently.
Now that is awful. I mean, when any jumping into any new business or any new venture where, you know, basically you're the safety net, you're everything is, it can be, I guess, frightening. So, you know, kudos for doing it. That's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much. It's it was a really big moment. It was like a huge deal to actually step out and do this kind of stuff. But the two of us, we've been working together for so long. I mean, so Roger was one of the original people working in Warhammer TV about 7.5 years ago now, I think, maybe 8, possibly even more than that. And we kind of, God, it'd be even longer. It's a long time now. But the two of us met when they were doing this How to Paint Sit-Down Miniatures book. And they wanted to have a DVD along with it. And the TV studio was brand new stuff there. And I just got assigned to it because my schedule was kind of free. But the two of us met each other then. And we just got on like a house on fire with this idea of we can use video to help unlock these techniques of people and break down barriers. Because, you know, all my time working in the hobby, and even before, you know, when I was a kid experiencing it growing up, it's always been a case of how do you do these things? And people are scared of, you know, basically getting it wrong or painting a bad model and everyone making fun of them and all that sort of thing. So I've always been about trying to unlock that. And Roger's always been about this medium of using it. In fact, even when he applied for the job to do this TV studio stuff, he had to make a little concept video when he set up in his own house a painting tutorial video. So he's always been into this sort of thing. So the two of us hit it off really well with this kind of thing. And we've always been supportive and pushing each other when doing it. So when we did make the commitment of, all right, we're going to do this, you know, when we had our scary, shaky moments, the other one would be there to reassure him of like, look, it's all right, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. If things don't work out, this is the backup plan. But you know what? We've got to give it everything we've got and do our best.
Yep.
So it's been, in many times, it's been incredible. It's been stressful. It's been scary. It's been exciting. It's been so many of these things, but it's so much fun to be able to do whatever we want and target things that we think people want to see and be able to do it in our own way and represent it in our own style and, you know, all these things. It's been a real magical 6 months, I think.
Life
feels very different now. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's awesome, man. And what's the name of the channel? If so, people haven't found it already.
On YouTube, it's the Duncan Rhodes Painting Academy. And we have a website, which is duncanrhodes.com. And so the whole thing is called Duncan Rhodes Painting Academy. Feels very self-aggrandizing to be using my name in this way. And I assure you, it wasn't my idea. I wanted to call it something else. But Roger, one day he said that he thinks we should use my name for it. And the reason being, people understand what they're going to get when my name's associated with it. Because we were completely then reliant upon giving the word out ourselves. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't have this multi-million £5 company promoting us in different ways. It's up to us to do it. We have to use everything we've got when it comes to people understanding what they're going
to
see.
Yeah, no, I get it, man. Don't have to say anything like that to me. I completely get it. And people trust what you the way you've approached painting. And that's kind of one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you about this stuff. Is there's a new edition coming out pretty soon.
Yeah.
And it's filled with all wondrous new miniatures.
Yes. it's actually really exciting seeing it from the outside in now.
Right, just get to you get to see it as it comes out in its polished form, I guess, instead of maybe some proto sculpts or images and things like that. But people are going to, I imagine anyway, going to be looking as maybe an excuse to start a new army or paint some new figures that they don't have any experience with. And I thought it'd be great to talk to you about, you know, maybe what does starting a new painting project look like if someone is, let's say, they're wanting to get some of these Marines and paint them in a chapter color scheme that only exists in their mind or something they just haven't done yet, or a Necron dynasty that they haven't, well, with things like the Silent King and different Satan coming out, that, you know, they may be wanting to experiment. Like, how does someone approach a new project with painting, and how would you do it? How do you do it?
Well, when it comes to starting a new army, I always start with the core trooper because they're the one that you're going to have the most of. They're the one you're going to spend the most time on. And the project can be inspired by any figure in a range, you know, any kind of thing that you see. Like, you might see the Silent King and go, that's the most amazing model I've ever seen. I want that in my army. You're going to have to start out with some warriors, though, because you need the warriors to form the army. Unless, of course, you just want to pick the model, in which case, you know, go for it. But so I always take a basic trooper of the army. And what I'll do is, these days, I've got pretty good at visualizing the color scheme before I really go to it. But normally what I'll do is get a single miniature and I'll paint it with the idea in mind. And if it's not working out the way I want, I'll just start repainting and adjusting bits until I'm happy with it. And I note down what I'm doing. So I end up with a kind of little script, so to speak, kind of based on what we do for the videos, I suppose. And then you can hone that down to reduce the steps and reduce the colors, make it quicker and simpler and stuff. But if you want to, before committing to painting a miniature, what you can always do is just find a piece of black and white art of the figures, or even just a photo of one of them. You can print it out and then paint over it in the colors that you want in the various areas of it. Or, you know, you can even just get a paint document together and just put flat the colors on there that you want to use and just see how they work together. So you can use these little tricks to visualize it. But when you have that initial core trooper painted and you're happy with it, then you know you've got a good footing.
Yeah. So paint the test scheme, make some notes about how you did it.
Exactly.
And then see if there's a way, if you didn't like the time it took to do it, how to revise it from there.
Exactly. Yeah. And when you're happy with it, then I'd then go out and paint the whole unit, the initial trooper unit, what you want. And I'd start that initial army with the numbers required for usually those start collecting boxes. So I'd go for a regular squad of troopers. I'd go for a character to lead them. Not necessarily the biggest, baddest character there, just like a good standard starter character, and then some kind of cool elite unit or vehicle or something like that, because that's really the minimal requirement to play a game. And I always find playing a fun game with your new models is the most addictive thing to get you to want to go and paint some more stuff. So I always make a beeline for that initial, the minimum required to play. And nowadays
you can do that. So, yeah, so whatever, 500 point, 1,000 points or something like that. Get that fully up to speed on the table. Play with it a little bit to reconfirm your suspicions of why you started it in the first place.
Exactly. Yeah, and try out all these cool little things that you want to do. And it also teaches you about how the army works, so you can start to make more informed choices on what you want to add next to the force. It's especially good if you have some friends who are doing this at the same time as you, because then all of you can kind of do it at the same pace. And I found that even when doing like campaigns and things, when you have a group of friends doing all that together, that's again a good thing to push each other to get that next unit done and that next thing completed and stuff. So I'd look at stepping stones like that and start building from there.
That's pretty cool. You know, I hadn't really thought of it that way before, is that you really do, you need a little bit of confidence boosters along the way to keep you motivated to get everything done. Because I guess everybody gets to the point where there is that slog element where you're on your 90th pouch or something.
Yes. Yes.
Do you feel that way? Do you get that way? And then what are some of the ways that you push past that?
Oh yeah, I absolutely do. Sometimes you do kind of think to yourself, oh, I don't want to do another one. but what I do in those situations is I very rarely, almost never have just one project that I'm working on at a time. I'll normally have numerous different things and they'll be for different games. And I'll just kind of jump between them. If I'm getting tired of one thing, I'll do something else and then jump back and things. So, I mean, for example, if like I'm liking the look of the new Necrons myself for this new edition, and if I'm powering through those and I'm, you know, well into the Warriors and I'm starting to get tired and I want to do something else, then I'll take a look at one of the historical armies that I'm doing at the time, I don't know, ancient Greeks or something like that, and I'll paint a few of those, and that kind of is a palate cleanser for me because then I can return to that army and continue it. But again, those stepping stones help reduce that problem, because when you hit one of those points, you feel like you've kind of, you could just stop there and you don't feel guilty and you can play and you can do your stuff. But inevitably, when you play that game and you have lots of fun, you're going to want to do something else. So, you know, you won't care about having to paint a few more pouches. You'll be like, yeah, I want to do that so I can then add that and enjoy that experience on a larger level.
That's interesting. One of the things we've talked about on the show before is that motivation is great. Like when you are motivated, capture it and run with it. But there, you're going to get to a point where that fails you. Like motivation won't be there. So you kind of have to trick yourself to get through that until you summon up some more motivation at the time. But I think that's the case with everything. It's not, the hobby is that it's not a quote unquote chore, but there are times I think when we get to, like, especially when we're dealing on the concept of painting full armies, that we do have to look for different ways to get break through those barriers of resistance that we've created for ourselves. The 100th pouch, the 200th chainsaw, or whatever. Well, but it looks so good when it's done. It's just hard to visualize getting there sometimes.
That's the thing, yeah. I mean, there are lots of little hacks that you can do that make things easier. And you've also got to bear in mind that the only person that really matters when it comes to approval of the army is yourself, because it's your project. You know, it's very much an expression of you. And with the videos that Roger and I do, we do tend to highlight every detail on it. And the main purpose for that is to show people, like, this is the sort of stages you go through for, like, the Back at Games Workshop, the studio painted armies, not the heavy metal ones, but the army painted team ones. That was the kind of standard of which we were doing them to. But the truth is, you don't have to highlight all those things that we do. If you're trying to, if you could, I'd recommend, from the style of video that we do, just going up to the point where all the layering is done and stop there, and your model's going to look great, especially when you have a large amount of them. If you want to do the highlights, but you don't want to do them all, don't have to do all the pouches and belts and stuff like that, just concentrate on the main colours of the model and the face as well. The face is a really important thing, that if you fully complete the face, your model will look better than you might think it does, because that's what the focal thing that people immediately look at. So if you do that, then a few highlights on whatever the main part of the colour scheme is, leave it there, your army's going to look great. And as long as you're happy with it, then that's cool. So, yeah, you mustn't feel like you have to do every detail and have to highlight everything.
Gillum and Flesh, the contrast paint, is absolutely amazing.
Yes.
If you are terrible at painting, not you, this is not, I'm not trying to, I'm talking to the listeners now. Duncan, please ignore me for a second. You can do this. But if you don't feel like you're strong at painting faces, Gillum and Flesh will do it for you. And I don't know if you, have you tried that? I think it's one of all the contrast paints, I think it's the best.
Oh, well, contrast paints are great. So I think people are still sort of like working out what exactly you can do with them. I know Games Workshop presents them in a very sort of formulaic way of you just paint all the colours of contrast. But when you start to really think about what you can do with them, you can do some actually very impressive things. I do have on my desk just to the left of me here. So, listeners have to forgive me because I'm not about to talk about something other than Warhammer for a second. But I've got a group of friends who are really into historical stuff, and they particularly love the Napoleonic period. And they're all learning to paint Napoleonic stuff and, you know, paint armies for those. And as you know, for those kind of uniforms with all the cross belts, piping colours, they're very complicated uniforms. So I worked out painting a single French soldier using almost entirely contrast paints, of layering them in a particular way that it allows you to rattle through all the details very quickly. And then you just use a few layer paints to pick out the piping and things.
And those aren't 32 millimeter miniatures either or whatever.
These are 28 millimeter figures. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So they're about as tall as, if you think, if people are familiar with the Lord of the Rings figures, they're basically that sort of size and detail. Gollum and Flesh is used for skin on those. It's super easy to, if you think about it in a logical order and sort of pick, like, start with the paler colours and work towards the darker, stronger colours, it all just falls into place. So, yeah, by using those, they're such a great addition. So it's a video I want to do, actually. I want to show people, like, you know, how you can quickly paint these complex uniforms by just putting the paints in a certain order and being neat, basically.
well, you bring that up, but, I mean, finding, when I'm going and watching tutorials, I'll poke around at them at different ones till I find something that I can relate to. Something that I feel like I can replicate. Like, they get a result that I feel like looks good enough for me and I can replicate it. And so even if it's not the miniature that I'm trying to paint, I mean, it is very helpful when it is the miniature I'm trying to paint, but you can often find something in one of these tutorials to take and apply to a miniature that you want to paint, even if they aren't painting one.
Yes, absolutely. And we think about tutorials in that sort of way of like people can basically pluck this effect and use it on other stuff. Now, in the academy, we do have a technique section, which over time we're going to be filling out, explaining each of these techniques as a particular thing so that people can exercise on that thing. But we recently did one. We used a miniature from Infinity. We blended the armor. So all the armor plates are yellow, but they have like orange shading on them, and each panel goes from yellow to orange. And it's easy to do when you see it in motion. And we use a wet palette for it, and you can see us combining, mixing the colors and, you know, getting the effect there. But then we know that people have been using that on Imperial Fists. So this is the kind of thing that we want to encourage. And, you know, I hope people keep an open mind when they watch a guide of, even if they're not collecting that model, they'll probably learn something from it that they can use on their own things.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned a wet palette, though. Do you often find yourself... I don't use a wet palette. I think I may be one of the last holdouts of people. But I also have no idea what I'm doing, so...
So I do have one. It's an army painter one. Yeah, I use it sometimes. I'm like you in that I'm used to my regular palette, which is a plate, which I've had for years and years. And the reason why I'm used to one of those is because that's just what I got into the hobby with. You know, that's what the Games Workshop stores when I was learning to paint had, their little tiles. And on the in the Games Workshop painting videos, of course, the palette pad is what we used because that's what Games Workshop sells. And I'm just used to it. I still like the palette pad. I've got one. If I go away for like a weekend and I'm going to be locked in a hotel room for a while, I'll take my paints with me and the palette pad, because it's just a convenient thing to take along. But the wet palette is something that I get out for specific reasons for certain techniques. So like I mentioned, the blending effect. I used it on that because you need to. And when it comes to our videos, it's not the reason for us generally not using the wet palette isn't because of me just being used to using a regular one. It's because we're always trying to minimize costs required to replicate what we're doing. And it's easier to go and buy a plate, like a pound plate from a shop called Wilco.
That's very nice. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the reason for it. But if people want to use a wet palette, then they totally should and they can do. And when we need it, that's when we bring it in and we want to use it because we've got a specific reason for it being there, not just to say, hey, buy this one. It's going to cost you this much money. So yeah, it's always an attitude we've had about these videos.
Yeah, that's cool. And I noticed recently you did a kit bash for a train, like a 40K train. Now, look, regular trains don't like do it for me. I know that they capture interest for a lot of people, but I always stop and look when I see a 40K train. Those do actually fascinate me. Did you just decide to do that? Did you get a request? Like, what? How did you come to that conclusion to make a train?
Well, I don't know if you remember way, way back when the initial version of Apocalypse came out, there was a battle report in the book where there was a battlefield that was like an Ultramarines versus Tyranid thing. And on the snowy battlefield, there was a railway line on it. And this really crazy looking 40K train had been made for it. And it's incredibly detailed. It's a beautiful model and it looks like real sci-fi. And I remember seeing that and thinking like that's. Along with the Cities of Death that had come out not long before, it was kind of a part of world building in 40K of like, these are mundane things that we have in our world. What do they look like in that world? Mm-hmm. And it's like a thing that you associate with, which draws you into the lore deeper. And I often thought afterwards, you know, how would that thing's incredibly expensive and you need a lot of, like, to get the parts for it, if you can identify them, and then you need the skill to make it. So how could you do one that's simpler? And so I was always thinking about it and trying things, and never quite worked. Now, when the crane set came out, the galvanic servo haulers, I remember the front of one of those things looks like a train, and I was like, oh, maybe it's something else. Yeah. And I kept like coming out with ideas. And one day I was just fiddling around with that kind of boiler piece from the Sector Mechanica stuff, turned it sideways and went, that's a boiler from an industrial steam engine in the UK. I remember as a kid going on trains pulled by something that looked like that. And so I just started sticking bits together and it just kind of happened. And I was like, oh, I've done it. So I started trying to hone it down to use minimal kits. So in the video, it looks like you need a lot of kits, but really it's you just need the there's one scenery box you need, and really you need specific bits out of those frames, and then you just need some kind of control console with which you can use anything, and then a couple of bases, which everyone always has bases lying around. So it's not that
it's
crazy,
weird
really.
How everyone yes like where do they mm-hmm. where do they all come from? Like, I know I don't have any figures out there with no bases on them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do I have a stack of 25 millimeter bases just sitting on my
Exactly. Yeah. How does it happen? But that thing was wholly designed of how do you do it with minimal stuff? How is it accessible to everybody? Minimal skill required to convert it, really. And I think when you look at it, you realize, oh, yeah, it looks just like a train when you just turn it on its side, this main piece for it. And then making all the wagons around it is dead easy. So I think then it kind of builds a narrative on your battlefield if you have that thing there. It kind of suggests that this is an industrial yard where heavy lifting and things are going to happen. And then one thing leads to another. I imagine, like, sooner or later, someone's going to make something quite elaborate with it, maybe like some sort of metro thing, you know, like some more civilian hab block kind of area, and then base their battles around that sort of thing. So, yeah, it was just the kind of thing that came to life. And I was excited to do it. And I keep thinking of what things you could do on top of it to expand it and make something more elaborate and bigger. So, you know, I'm excited to see in the future what people make out of that idea.
Oh yeah, man! Absolutely, I'm excited about seeing more of your videos on that kind of thing. I mean, you just described a way of approaching some making your table looking better from a very like internal core thing, which is I don't think everyone does that. They just kind of look at function. But if I can speak about function a bit, is that what you've been talking about with your tutorials is about getting to the goal that you want, whatever your personal goal is. And I'm not sure that everyone knows how to start. Like they may think, oh, I've got to get all these tools. I've got to get all these brushes and all these paints. And it sounds like you kind of come at it from a different way of just, you know, figuring out a way to get up to what your playable, what you need, what you want out of it.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, the guides that we were doing over the years, back when we started them, they were very much Wild West kind of stuff that we just sort of did what we thought people would want to see. And so we just painted the model in the way that at the time, the hobby team is what they were called, in the way that they would have done something. And when I would then get the list of the paints I'd written into my script to give it onto Roger for him to make all his color swatches and things, I realized actually that's a massive list of paints. What can I take out of there to reduce it still? And even then the list stays quite big. Now you can mix colors to get your highlights and things. We would generally avoid that so people would have the specific color they needed to copy exactly what we're doing. But over time we've gradually got to the point where, well, we kind of want to hit a point that's a bit sort of halfway through the video where it's like, you can stop here if you want to. We're now going to add extra details. These are optional. And that reduces the color list further. But it's very easy to forget when you're into this hobby for a while that one of the most important things of it is bringing new players into the games. Because these hobbies, any hobby, relies upon getting new blood in. If you right from the start tell somebody you need all of this stuff to start, it's quite an off-putting thing. So it's always
I know you just bought your figures, but now you need $150 worth of paints and brushes.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And like, oh, I need all that. Oh, I mean, I remember in retail when I was working in, like, when around Christmas time, and you have parents coming in to buy the core game for 40K. And it's like, yeah, now here's all the additional equipment required to paint the miniatures. And you'd start thinking to yourself, I just recommended them four paints to paint the blue of their ultramarines. You know, do they need those highlights at that point? Is it appropriate? Not really. Yeah, so very easy to forget. And also, it's very easy to look at things through the lens of an experienced hobbyist of what would you want. And a core tenet in Games Workshop retail certainly was, remember, it's not your hobby, it's their hobby. And so what does that person want to do? So you've always got to try and remember that people are going to be into it for different things. If you're trying to welcome new players in, they're going to be wanting different sorts of game. Like if you're running a club, for example, and you've got a new player and they're very inexperienced and stuff, you don't put them against the top tournament player in your club because they're going to smash them and it's going to put them off. You know, these kind of things are always infused in it. So you've always got to think of it from the perspective of a new person if you're helping them into it. And it's worth doing because I do think people who really get into this hobby, it changes their life. We end up with it all the way through. All my friends I've got to know through Warhammer in one way or another. So it's, you know, I'd hate someone to be denied that opportunity from having a bad game, you know, or someone making fun of how thick their highlights are on something, for example, you know.
Oh, yeah, I reserve that just for the people that I know the best, that I like the best. I have a core print. You never hobby shame. You never ever hobby shame because you know, it's, everyone's coming in their own journey and they may be spending the same amount of time as you and, you know, it's, you may not be getting the same result, but I don't like when I'm looking at other people's Twitters and stuff on Instagram, it's like, I don't even know how some of that stuff is possible. But I want to get there and I don't let it stop me from trying.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. You shouldn't ever let this stuff, like you can admire these kind of things of how beautiful they are, but you shouldn't ever let it put you off.
There you go. Are you working on anything like personally for yourself?
Oh, I'm working on many things. So at the moment, on my desk, I've got some Lumineth Realm Lords because we've been doing some of that stuff for the Academy. So at the time this is this podcast goes out, people will see that we've got one of the Wardens on our website already. And I'm going to be working on some of the other models. So I'm about to do some prep stuff for that. And I really like those figures. So that might be my next Warhammer army once I've cleared one of my other projects off my desk.
Man, those models are insane. I mean, like with the long spears and things like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, the stuff that I don't think you would have you could have seen or would have expected to see from something that was still like a rank and file game.
Mm-hmm.
It seems yes. like they're kind of pressing the limits, you know, finding new limits, I guess is probably what I should say about mm-hmm. Model design and fantasy gaming ideas.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, these elves, they're armed with, they're not really spears either, they're pikes, you know, they're massive. And I remember back in Warhammer Fantasy days, the old Dogs of War that had pike units. I remember, you know, we couldn't make plastics of those because they'd be too fragile and stuff. But here they are. You know, they come out with them and they're cool. So it makes you wonder, you know, what stuff's going to be in the future. But yeah, I reckon some Realm Lord stuff might be in my future. I certainly like the look of the new Necrons on the way. But I need to finish off some stuff before I let myself really get into some new things. I've got some different game stuff. I've got the Night's Watch for A Song of Ice and Fire just here, and I've got some clones for Star Wars Legion that I need to finish as well. So once I've got one of those done, I'll have a free slot and I can think about doing something else.
Oh, that's nice. So have you played Legion? Have you Star Wars Legion? Do you like
I haven't yet. No, because of lockdown, I've not been able to, but I did acquire the parts for an army. So I thought, you know, I may as well paint it. You know, I hope I like the game. But I've been doing the, I decided I didn't just want to do generic clones. I decided I want to do a specific unit of them. So I looked around the internet at different ones and I ended up going for the 91st Recon, which if you folks out there have seen episode 3, they're the ones who shoot down the Jedi that's on the jet bike, other than the speeder bike. And I like them because they've got weird helmets and this weird marking, which mm-hmm. looks almost like the tower marking, which is quite funny. But yeah, I really like the weird look of them. And if you look at drawings and things people have done online of them, I like the randomness of the red markings they have. So yeah, I've been doing an army of those. I've got about 9 more regular clones to paint and then a tank and the army will be done.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, but I'm really looking forward to playing with them. It's going to be cool to give it a go.
It's got that, from what I understand about it, it's got that kind of you go, I go type mechanic activations and stuff to it.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
you know, different you know, than we have on the Warhammer side.
Yeah. Well, I can see it's got lots of cards in it. And I'm interested to see, like, as I understand it, you have a hand that declares your activation at the start of the turn. I don't really understand the ins and outs of it yet, but it sounds very interesting. And Song of Ice and Fire has a card mechanic in it, which really brings the game to life. And I love that. So, you know, I'm excited to see how the games interpret it. So, yeah.
Were you more a fan of the books or the show, or either or not or neither? Just could be a figure fan.
So I'm one of those people who really enjoyed the show up until the latter parts, which was a bit of a shame. But when the show was good, it was really good. So, you know, I certainly appreciate it for that. And it got me interested in another fantasy world, which I just wouldn't have looked at otherwise. And since watching the show, I then started listening to the audiobooks whilst I paint stuff. And I like it because it feels like a living, breathing world. These are all things that are important to me when it comes to wargaming stuff. You know, I want to be able to understand the culture of the army it is I'm collecting. So it's, that infuses me into it. It encourages me to start making scenery themed on it. It sort of determines my choices in the army that I go for. And yeah, Song of Ice and Fire has got a lot of that. So I've been really enjoying those stories. Yeah.
Nice.
Counter characters that are like, oh, I really like you. I really like you. Oh, I really hate you. You know, so.
that was one of the best things the show did. Yeah, you did. Mm-hmm. You did start to hate and love the characters. When I first became aware of like your hobby interest, and you as a Bretonnian player and then a Knight player, I think I saw that you were dabbling like in the Chaos Knight range. And then I've seen a tutorial that you did about Death Guard. Are we going to see the darker side of Duncan Rhodes coming out anytime soon?
Oh, it's the knight stuff became a little bit of a character, really. It was fun to do that and people were enjoying it. There's so many stuff in Warhammer that I really like. So, like, there's so many cool factions and things, and I've always wanted to collect different ones. Now, with Chaos Marines, I wanted to do a Chaos Marine army, but I thought compared to how the Imperial Marines had evolved, I thought the Chaos Marines had been left behind, so it just sort of put me off doing it. Especially when Primaris Marines are going around and you stood a normal Chaos Marine next to them. They looked kind of like children. Now, I then saw that the new Chaos Marines were on the way, so I just held off until they came out. So I have been doing some Word Bearers. I've not had time to really complete the army, actually. It's something, again, I need to get done. But yeah, I do love those new Chaos Marine styles.
Oh, every figure we've seen has been out of control. I mean, that's again, just you things that in your mind you look at, like, I don't know, Space Marine Vanguard veteran with two lightning claws, and you think it's never going to get any better than this. Like, this is amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, and then, and here we are 5-10 years later, and we've got these new models that we thought, you know, that it's never going to get any better than this, and then it's going to get better than that.
Well, it's the subtle bits of character. So I find so like intriguing. So it's not really about, because obviously there are all these crazy weapons and stuff. My favorite Chaos Marine miniature is one of the ones that you can build from the regular box set, who's holding his bolter in one hand and he's feeding the ammunition into it with the other. That is such a Chaos Marine looking thing that I've been seeing in the artwork since, you know, I got into this stuff way, way, way back in the 90s. And to see that as an actual miniature realized in that detail, I absolutely love that guy. He's brilliant. So, nice. Yeah, probably I probably ought to build on my Word Bearers collection, actually, and do that for new edition.
All right. Yeah. Well, yeah, man. Well, I got, here's a couple of kind of like silly questions. Do you have a favorite color paint?
Rakarth Flesh.
All right. Do you really find it because it just has so many uses, or is it like what?
It's a really handy color. I like the sort of like dark ivory it is, and sort of dark kind of marbleish color. It's very easy to highlight over. It's very useful for all kinds of colors to go over the top of it. It covers very well. I just find I always seem to use it. It's great. It's really, really good color.
I like that. Okay. For brush sizes, it's what I see is that when painting people doing tutorials, when they get better at the brush sizes, they tend to use larger brushes for detail work that I need, like the smallest of small brush.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Is there good like just size that's just going to be, could be your go-to size for any project?
I'd say a Citadel medium layer. You don't necessarily need the Artificer layers. They are higher quality bristles, but a medium layer is still good. As long as you look after it, it'll last you for a long time. That one is just a good all-around size. On the other hand, it can't do everything. You definitely want a larger brush for your initial blocking out of colours. Medium base brush is great for that. From the Army Painter, I really like a regiment brush for that sort of thing, because that's like a larger version of a medium layer. And then for more detailed things, a small layer or an Army Painter character brush is kind of what I tend to go for. But those sort of three sizes are the ones that gravitate around. A medium layer being the in-between of all those things, I'd say, is probably the most useful one you could get hold of.
I like that. Again, and then past that point, do you seal your miniatures? And then do you prefer a satin or matte varnish?
Yes, I do. I prefer a matte varnish. For vehicles, I actually use Munitorum varnish from Games Workshop from Citadel. That one, it can go a bit satin depending on what weather conditions are like. So you have to kind of wait for a more middle of the road kind of day, not too hot, not too cold. But yeah, I always spray large vehicles with that. For infantry miniatures, I varnish by hand, and what I use is AK Interactive's Ultra Matte varnish. Now, this is, I like a dead matte finish to things, but this finish is so dead matte that I've actually started mixing in other varnishes with it to take the edge off. So what I tend to do, my personal mix, is I go for AK Interactive Ultra Matte, and then I mix it 50-50 with contrast medium, and I find that gives a matte finish with just a hint of satin to it, so it doesn't completely dull all the colours totally. And then if there's lots of metallics on it, I'll then paint over the metallics with contrast medium on its own to give it a slight sheen, but not too much.
Wow, so AK Ultra Matte.
AK Interactive Ultra Matte, yeah.
50-50 and it comes in quite a large bottle. Medium.
Yeah, the actual nib of it is one of the dropper bottles that you'll get with Army Painter and Vallejo, but the bottle itself is quite large. If you stacked three pots of Citadel paint on top of each other, that would be the same height as what this bottle is.
Oh, wow.
And it lasts for a long time. The bottle I've got has been lasting me for a year now, and I'm about halfway through it.
last one about transfers. Do you use transfers? Is there any shame in using transfers?
No shame whatsoever. Transfers are an incredible tool, and people should absolutely use them. And even if you want to do freehanding stuff, transfers are actually excellent as a template to put down and then freehand over the top of it. So like if you wanted to give the illusion of, say you go for some heraldic design and a shield, for example, right? You pop the transfer on, then start painting highlights onto it as if you base coated it, and then it'll give the impression of it being 3D. So it's a cool little trick for that. Yeah, I definitely recommend transfers. You don't have to use the softener that a lot of people swear by using softeners and things like Microsol and Microset, which you'll see banded around quite a bit. You don't have to use those if you're applying transfers to flat surfaces. If you're doing things on curved surfaces, you'll find it's difficult to get them to adhere correctly with just water, so you might want to look into those then. But if you're doing something smooth like the side of a tank, you don't need to worry about it. Just make sure that you varnish the surface first with a gloss varnish, then put the transfer over because the gloss varnish gives a smooth finish that prevents air from being trapped underneath it. You get, it's called silvering if you get the air stuck underneath it because it looks like little silver dots. And then you go over the top of that with a varnish, like a matte varnish again, and that seals it down and flattens it and stuff. So yeah, I definitely recommend them. I think they give a sense of life to a miniature that you don't otherwise get, especially with things like bigger stuff like knights, but even smaller things like tanks and things. If you put little hazard markings on and kill counts and stuff like that, it just makes your model look so, so cool.
I actually changed my transfer game after watching one year. Forever, I've got a medium-sized cup that I would just fill with water. I clip the little thing out and throw the thing in the water. Well, not throw it. Place it and let it float on the top of the water. And then when fish it out when I thought it was time. I saw you take some paint, you know, you take a paintbrush and then put some water on the transfer on a piece of tissue or somewhere outside of the cup of the water that was so perilous. Mm-hmm. And I use that now, and it's really, I can't believe I didn't think of it sooner.
I know. It's one of those things that's like, that's obvious, but these are things that aren't obvious until someone tells you, like so many things in miniature painting, like straight down to using your palette, right? The tooth and coat stuff. If you don't know, then you're not going to figure it out straight away. If someone tells you, it's like, oh, of course. But this is one of the things that I was taught in the studio when I joined, because I used to do what you did of just dropping the transfer into water. And then one day, one of the guys who was there was like, if you do that, these are the downsides of it. Do it like this.
30% of them.
Exactly. Yeah. If you do it like this, you won't lose the transfer. It retains more of like the adhesive that makes it stick to your model and stuff. It just basically works out in better in every way. And it's like, oh, yeah, you're right. So, yeah, well, there's a lot of little tricks like that you learn from watching other people.
Yeah, Duncan, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. We mentioned where people can find you, and I will put that in the show notes. What's next? Well, I know you mentioned a little bit what's coming out on the channel, but what are some things that people can really start to look forward to?
Our general schedule, I suppose you could call it, is so we have our YouTube channel and we have our website. Now, on the YouTube channel, we usually put a video there every 2 weeks, which is one of the ones that we also put onto the website. Now, the website is membership to basically allow us to feed ourselves. It's $3.99 a month. And over the course of the month, you'll get 7 to 8 videos, including the ones that we put for free on there. And that will include, we're aiming for one big video a month. So the one that we've just done is Gazgul Thraka, for example. That video is just a bit over an hour, I think. And we also have lots of techniques in there, lots of advanced things, and we cover a whole host of subjects. So there's Warhammer 40,000 and Age of Sigmar there. We're going to be expanding a bit more Lord of the Rings, but there's a number of other games too. So that's the main source of content from us. However, people can always talk to me anytime. I'm on Instagram, where I am Duncan J. Rhodes. That's the letter J. And I'm on Twitter as well, which is @TwoThinCoats. And yeah, people are welcome to chat to me, ask me questions, whatever they want to, really. And yeah, please do follow us on YouTube if you want to see some of the stuff that we're doing.
Awesome, man. Well, have a great rest of your afternoon, and we'll be back in touch real soon.
Thanks very much. See you all later.
You're listening to Forge the Narrative.
We are back, man. So great to have Duncan on. I know it feels maybe weird to box in like a hobby segment while we're talking about crunchy point stuff, but maybe just consider that your moment of zen.
Yeah, palate cleanser between the thick concrete, but that is the points of section.
God, well, and he's also a joy to talk to. Look forward to having maybe him on more often to talk about some of the cool things and hobby tips and maybe kickstart our finishing move segment again.
That's awesome, man. I do love seeing the stuff he's been putting out recently. It just blows me away how good of a painter he is.
Yeah. And if you didn't catch last week's episode, for some reason, we had Dan Hamden on.
Man, yeah, if you haven't, go back and listen to it. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, for crying out loud, what a champion. Very, very pleased to have him on. Can't thank him enough for joining us. But the same with all our guests. People take time out of their day to come and speak to us and bring, you know, and help us with the show. Absolutely amazing. Okay, I'm ready to talk about the points. Oh,
yes, man. I am so keen.
So guard tanks, yeah. I mean, you got to think the tanks got some really beneficial rules now. And what have you been playing? What did you play with? What dropped you or drew your eye to the earliest?
I'm an avid treadhead, and I played 6th edition with Guard, I've played the start of 7th edition with Guard, 8th edition with Guard, and I'm going to be starting 9th edition with Guard as well, and I'm going back to my mechanized roots. So I've been looking at Chimeras a lot. So one of the big Guard changes is that A lot of mainstay weapons, auto cannons, heavy bolters, heavy flamers, I think plasma cannons as well, have these split profiles, 10 points on a one profile for a non-vehicle choice and one profile for the vehicle choice.
Points cost, what you mean, right?
Yes. Okay. Yes, of course, points cost. Apologies. Also, las cannons have this points cost as well. So they're creating this line in the sand saying that we know guard is powerful and we know that guard is more powerful the more vehicles you take. So the cost is gonna add up a lot more on that front. But we also know you can take these things on literally toughness 3 paper mache bodies, literally with their cardboard armor and their just good old will to live. So we're not going to punish you so much for taking that. That is, I love that idea. I love that little bit of balancing nuance they've done there. It really appeals to me. So what I'm looking at the moment is I'm looking at Chimeras. Now, it's a weird thing to think that heavy bolters and heavy flamers are the same points now. 10 points each on a non-vehicle and 15 points each on a vehicle. So they've almost made the choice for you. Like, if you can take heavy flamers in this edition, you probably want to take heavy flamers, seeing as the same points as heavy bolters, unless you are an absolute dedicated backline Wyvern Basilisk or Battle Cannon Tank Commander. You're not a demolisher or anything. You don't need to get into the midboard to do your damage.
I would always take heavy flamers on my Wyverns because people would try to come in. Like, Snickrot would always come on. Like, you don't want to come around here.
Yeah. Yeah, but now you have to pay a CP for that guy. When Snickrot goes to the charge, you got to pay a CP to fire that one heavy flamer. Like, I'm not sure it's as good.
I'm with you. I'm just saying that that would be like the secret tech was heavy flamers in the back.
Of course, yeah. So starting with Chimeras, they went up 5 points on the chassis and only 1 point up 2 points on the heavy bolters, 1 point on the heavy flamers. So essentially, if you took a double heavy flamer Chimera, your tank's gone up 7 points. That is horrendously reasonable. That is so overtly reasonable for how much more powerful I believe these tanks are going to be and how much better I think they're going to be. And the heavy bolter one is still a really valid option. Plus 30 points is a bit rough, so going to 95. But if you 95 points for your double heavy flamer or double heavy bolter, which I think is the two better options. The multi-laser I just can't get behind anymore. No rend. Like, the only time that strength 6 is better is when you're shooting against toughness 6. Literally every other option, the heavy bolter is better than the multi-laser. Against toughness 5 and below, heavy bolter is better. Toughness 7 and up, heavy bolter is better. The vast majority of the time, I just go with the HBs. But like the las gun array, which is essentially the crappier guard equivalent to the Gorse array we just talked about before, but that's 0 points. Now, here's an interesting one. Heavy stubbers, they were 2 points. They're now 5 points. They've had one of the biggest increases that I can see. I mean, it's only a 3-point difference.
150% increase.
But it's exactly right. It's actually a huge percentage increase. And I used to be putting heavy stubbers on literally everything. I'd have 3 tank commanders. I'd put heavy stubbers on them. I'd have Chimeras. I'd put heavy stubbers on them.
The same with storm bolters. Like, you just put them everywhere.
Now, this is a fundamental thing. Like, I can't see anything. I look at all these points and this huge array of different stuff. There are so many things that used to be 2 points, 3 points, 7 points, 8 points. They're either been rounded up or rounded down to the closest 5 multiplier.
Now, with weapons, it's a little more granular. Like, a storm bolter is 2 points.
It is.
Sorry, 3 points.
It is.
It's not broken.
Yeah, there are still a few there.
If
but
you're
the
a body on a table, though, if you're somebody capable of performing an action or sitting on an objective or whatever, you're 5 points.
So, I mean, looking down the melee weapons for guardsmen, they're either zeros, fives, tens, fives. There's 1, 2, which is a sentinel chainsaw, which I don't know a single... Somebody in the comments tell me that you've taken a Sentinel's chainsaw. You've upgraded a Sentinel to have a chainsaw. I would like to high-five you or buy you a drink sometime because you're a braver man than I.
It's very, but, very fluffy, especially if you got catechins. Now, I don't own a single one with a chainsaw on it. I'll say that, but
if you're gonna do that, you just took the Forgeware Powerlifter ones and you got a Sentinel with a Power Fist. You're just like, skip the middleman, you know? But Lehman Russ has got a significant hit. Lehman Russ's went up by, I think it's around 30 points each. I'll double check that and I'll push the points through again later. But what I've been looking at is the infantry. Veterans, yeah. Veterans and infantry went up. Infantrymen and conscripts went up 1 point per model. I think we're all pretty much sure that was going to happen. They're all 5 points for the infantry and the conscripts, and now 6 points per model for the veterans. So it's still the same 1 point difference for better weapons loadouts and one ballistic skill. And with troops being necessary but not as necessary, I feel like veterans might see some more play. I'm looking at veterans with a bunch of flamers and heavy flamers. Heavy flamers have gone down in points, and so have flamers. Flamers have gone down 1 point. Used to be 6 points, and now they're 5. And heavy flamers, for I believe there were 14 points per model across the board. Now they're down to 10 points per model on infantry. So for a unit of 10 veterans with three flamers and a heavy flamer, it's 85 points. I feel like that's pretty good in a 100-point metal box that also has two heavy flamers on it as well. So 185 points. Good. 185 points, that is a lot of flame on. That is a lot of burny burn. And there's a lot of different synergies you can add up with that as well. I mean, Catachans have an order that you reroll get the amount of shots you get on the flamer boys. There's pyromaniacs, which is one of the custom traits to reroll once to wound with flamer weapons, as well as gunner experts. And yeah, there's a lot of stuff you can do with that. And I feel like that's a good unit for ramming onto an objective and forcing your opponent to get off and stay off. I'm looking at that one and I'm liking it a lot. The one I'm a little bit quizzical about is Tempestus Scions. Now, they've gone up 2 points per model. I feel like... Firstly, that's not in line with the other infantry. They're 2 points per model, more not 1 point. They were 7 points, and now they're 9 points. Let me just double check that. Yes, they are. Yeah, they were 7 points, and now they're 9 points. So that's up 29%. That's a little bit overs based on the rest of guard, but I still think it's pretty fair for what you get. I mean, and I think with what they can do and the amount of stuff they got in Psychic Awakening and their flexibility in their tech, I feel like that's fair. Where it doesn't add up is when you start comparing, and this is one thing I try not to do, but I'm human and I do it. I compare stuff in one faction with something similar in another faction. I don't know if you're ready to go there yet, Paul.
Let's get there in just a second. Let's talk about the effectiveness of still a five-man Scion unit for 45 points.
45 points. Well, see,
that's without special weapons.
What it is the same as, it's the same granularity as it was in the previous edition. So back then, infantry squads was 4 points per model. So 40 guys, 40 points for 10 guys. And it was 35 points for five Scions. Now it's exactly the same 5-point difference still now. It's 50 points for 10 infantry and it's 45 points for 10 Scions. So even though I think they've gone up, you know, more than the others, you know, when it boils down to it, they stayed in the same position relative to the rest of the units, so to speak. They're still in the same spot, the same niche. They still feel the same form and file.
Yeah, and with distinction in the guard, we talked about different point values for different things. A plasma gun and a melta gun cost a certain amount of points when you have a BS4+. Any other model, it costs more, double. So yeah. On a Scion with a 3+ ballistic skill, that costs 10 points.
Yeah.
But a plasma gun for 10 points is still pretty good.
Mm-hmm. It is pretty good. Now, one thing I do want to touch on, this might be an issue. I think there was this assumption that units that didn't need line of sight to shoot were going to get hit a bit harder than others. I'd say that for guard, that is not true. Wyverns, Basilisks, and Manticores have all had what I believe is very, very reasonable increases. I thought they'd be hit a lot harder than they have, or not so much hit. I thought they'd be increased more proportionally with how much more powerful people believe they're going to get. Because realistically, they've only gone up 15 points. From what I can tell, each. So a Basilisk was, I believe, around 110 points, 108 points, and now it's 120, you know? So, I think that could be a problem down the track if we find out that is too cheap. I've got this gut feeling that's too cheap.
with blast weapons and everything?
Just yeah. Maybe. Well, so a Wyvern was 113 points, and it's now 130. So 17 points, yeah, look, that's on par reasonable. And the Basilisk was, it was 108, and it's gone up to 120, so 12 points. And then the last one I wanted to look at was the Manticore. And bless their cotton socks, they put the Death Strike up by 10 points, guys. Watch out, because that was the one that was holding the floodgates back. Death Strike
and the Rucka Truck. Getting so beat good. With a Nerf stick.
Well, so yeah, and Manticores went up 15 points. So 5 points on their chassis. No, they didn't, unfortunately. Let me just recheck that. So the Heavy Bolter was 8 points, now it's 10 points. So they've gone up 7 points on the Manticore. All of those three tanks, I feel could be problems for the game going forwards, but we'll wait and see. Especially seeing as the Manticore and the Basilisk can be given flat 3 damage, it ignores cover. Basilisk and Wyvern can shoot twice, and all the extra, and them being, they're all blast weapons. All three of those were blast weapons, and they didn't go up as much as I thought they were going to. So we'll see what happens.
It's a real shame.
This is my hot take, by the way, is that I think that Catachans and Scions are going to be beastie. Just absolute beast mode in this edition, at least in the early days of this edition.
So a lot of people are talking about how the prevalence. So one of the things that's might hold guard back is if we get this big prevalence of anti-tank weapons, and we know how easy guardsmen are to kill. So as soon as you crack the Chimera or the Torox or whatever transport or Lehman Russes, the insides have never been gooier and easy to digest, and you can just mop up those guardsmen at will. And so people have been. I know some guard players and I talk with them pretty often. And they've all been pretty concerned, as well as me, that Bulgrim were going to get an exponential hit because we know how kind of powerful they've been at points in the last edition. Things having like a negative one armor save, e.g. like you go from 1+ to a 0+ to a negative one armor save, or having had a 2+ invulnerable for a little bit, and now they can pretty reliably get 3+ invulnerables. But they've been touched pretty reasonably. Like they got a 3-point increase. That's great for us, great for guardsmen, because they're our only linchpin counter-assault unit, and we need them. they're like necessary for us not to get flooded by intercessors and just pulled down and outscored. So I'm very happy with that change.
Yeah, well, you say you need that right now, but that's without the considering the factors of being able to shoot in combat, to not be paralyzed if some of your army gets... I mean, yes, I agree. I think it is good that they are a powerhouse, still a powerhouse, and that they didn't get impacted that much to be the case. But I think that we're going to see a bunch of small units. And then we were talking about the or at least I mentioned a second ago, that the plasma gun for 10 points might not, might still be a good buy on the Scions, but I think they're going to be really great, basically naked, just stocked, a bunch of 45-point units raining all over the place. Like the guard, yep. I mean, we already know they fit well into brigade detachments. That's a very comfortable mind space that we can be in. I think they're definitely going to fit into that brigade slot, being able to take up to, I mean, minimum of 6 troops, but up to 12 troops. And they could use every single one of those on things that are going to be able to perform actions, score things, be everywhere, and when necessary, apply pressure with some pretty cool war gear.
So I was actually incorrect. So Bulgrim's only gone up 1 point per model, as long as you take a slab shield. So Bulgrim Maul was 7 points. It's gone down to 5 points now. So even though their chassis, the actual Bulgrim model, has gone up 3 points, when you take the Bulgrim Maul, they're only gone up 1 point based on what they were before. Now, Brute Shield was the 4+ invulnerable safe shield, and that used to cost 0 points, now costs 5 points. So sprinkling those in is a lot more expensive, but the slab shield is still free. So you could take a Maul with just 2+ armor saves, and essentially you've only gone up by 1 point per model. And I think that's absolutely fantastic.
Mortars have pretty much doubled in cost.
Yes, that's an interesting one, yeah? Because I thought that's...
Yeah.
So I believe it was 18 points for a heavy weapons squad with all mortars. Let me just double check that. But yeah, I was pretty sure that was correct. Yes, 45 points. It's 15 points per heavy weapons team with a mortar. So what are they sitting at now? They are...
Heavy weapons squad is 7, so 21 points base without the weapon.
And then the mortar comes in at...
10 points apiece.
Healthy 10 points apiece. So look, they've gone up, 2 points per base? Is that correct? So that'd be 17 points per model?
Yeah, it looks like that. Yep.
It's a big, I think it's a big percentage-wise increase.
It is. Yeah, so it is. So 1 point on the chassis, on the two guys, and then 1 point on the actual mortar. So 17 points instead of 15 points each. So what does that come out in the wash? It's 51 points per squad now, per squad of three. So yeah, 153 points to fill out your heavy support, three options in a brigade. It's still the cheapest and
it's
easiest way to do it, I guess.
I think it's even better now than it was before.
I think it's really worth it. I think that's very much, so that went up by 17%, give or take. Wyverns went up by 14%. This is just on the chassis cost, by the way. This isn't on the actual adding up all the war gear, like the mandatory heavy bolters and such. And Basilisk went up by 10%. So yeah, all that line of sight shooting, I think it adds up to still being pretty fearsome.
Yeah, I think Guard right out of the gate are going to be incredibly powerful and something that people, they already have it, especially if you've been a Guard player for a long time. It's like you just accumulate these things. You're like, oh, I think I'd like to build 3 or 4 tanks today. You know, you just have them.
Now, one thing I want to touch on. So people were saying the Hellhounds were dead. The Hellhounds haven't come out that bad, considering that their actual Inferno cannon used to be 12. So, sorry, their chassis has gone up by 22 points, which is considerable. But the Inferno cannons come down by 10 points, so they've really gone up by 12 points. And then 2 points extra on the Heavy Bolter. So they've gone up by 14 points on the overall, which takes them from what was 101 points, sorry, to what, 114, 113? I think that's fine. No skies falling there.
The Hellhound, because
those flamer weapons aren't blast weapons, right?
Yeah, but I think flamer weapons are incredible. Like, they just seem incredible this edition. So, yeah, sure. Maybe they've been undervalued at the moment.
We go with the Catechins again. I think Hellhounds are also going to, are something that are probably going to see a resurgence in use, because there was a time when they were incredibly popular and you saw them all over the place, and then it kind of faded away, but I think they'll come back.
All right, one thing I need to draw people's attentions to. So about 4 or 5 episodes ago, I said, everyone, hold your breath, Castellans might be back. Now, I don't want to say I told everyone so, but they did drop what looks like 100 points. So, yeah, baby, watch out.
So back to, there we go, Castellans could be back.
I think they're pricing out at around 620 points at the moment.
There's nothing in the game that will block line of sight to them, so they gotta be tough. So maybe pick the toughest household.
Yeah. So, but I thought this might be a thing. Like when I was looking at if everyone's bringing a vehicle based armies, this the Knight Castellan is literally, apart from the Shadow Sword, which is maybe on par. The Castellan beats the Shadow Sword every time in a straight fight because of the invuln, but for the raw vehicle killing power, those two models are the kings, like the absolute kings, barring Titans. Yeah. And I think it being pretty reasonably costed for what seems, maybe some people need to be aware of.
Yeah, maybe so. But then, you know, the Radicators are going to hit the scene too.
They sure are.
The ones that we talked about, the ones that get a double shoot, they're 24-inch multi guns.
Yes, absolutely.
Those guys aren't going away.
Yeah, I'm not trying to rain on the Castellan parade, but there's going to have some things to contend with. You're going to have to build your army around boxing out those things, I think, if you plan. But that's not saying it can't be done. I mean, with some Phobos stuff or with other armies that you, I don't know, pair it with some Astromilitarum and then Rattlings begin to screen out your stuff. So anything to buy you one turn, the Castellan kills the Eradicators and then it's off to the races.
Exactly right. Or, you know, the Eradicators killed the Castellan and it's game on.
Well, then if those 300 points kill your 600 points, that's bad news. Probably bad news.
Yeah, it's a bad time.
So you were going to make some comparisons. We'll blur the lines a bit and we'll jump to comparing a couple of different factions. I know I moved us off of that topic for a second, but
no, it's fair.
It's pretty interesting.
We weren't ready. So I try and stay away from comparing cross factions, but there's sometimes it's undeniably awkward. So the one I was looking at was Tempest of Scions. So it's 9 points per model. And then I had a look at Dire Avengers. So when you compare the two, they're pretty much the same thing. They got essentially exactly the same stat line. They got the same 4+ armor saves, ballistic skill, weapon skill, strength, toughness, wounds, attacks, etc., etc., etc. It goes on. It's pretty much exactly the same across the board. Exceptions being the loadouts you can take for the units being pretty different. Like Tempest of Scions are very malleable. You can take a swathe of heavy weapons. And on top of that, they come with free deep strike.
You don't get melted guns on a Dire Avenger.
You don't. And they come locked. The only thing that's customizable is the Exarch, who admittedly has one more wound, but you're paying a premium for him. So here's the difference in points. 9 points per model. 9 points per model for the Scion. And was it 13 points or was it 14 points for the Dire Avenger?
God, that sounds so miserable right now.
It sounds pretty bad. Let me just double check the Craft World points. I don't want to lead anybody wrong. Dire Avenger, 13 points per model. Okay, so for 4 points difference, you don't get Deep Strike. You don't get plasma guns, melter guns, flamers, grenade launchers. Admittedly, like you could make an argument that the Dire Avenger catapult is better than the Hotshot Las Gun, but the Hotshot Las Gun is strength 3, rend 2, but the catapult's strength 4 with 6 is being rend 3. So you could possibly say the strength 4 is better. I think they're almost even. I think that almost comes out in the wash with the having the rend all the time. But for 4 points more, you essentially get the same thing, but a little bit worse because it doesn't have Deep Strike. That across, when you compare those things across factions, you start seeing some problems. Like that is an issue for Eldar players.
Dire Avengers, I mean, I think they have things they can do, stratagems you can lay on them that you can't necessarily get on a Scion, though.
Name one. I mean, Fire and Fade, yeah. But
Fire and Fade, lightning fast reactions.
Yep.
I can get that from a Psychic Power.
They get Craft World powers. Look, I'm playing slightly devil's advocate. Yes, I'm not taking Dire. I'm not taking Dire Avengers.
Well, that's the thing. I was thinking people would be taking Dire Avengers now because what you need is more troops in more squads, not bigger squads of troops. Like 10 Guardians, all of a sudden is vulnerable to all the blasts. 5 Dire Avengers still pack some poke in the shooting, and they can be more places than one unit of 10 dudes. They can be on two units of 5 can be on 2 objectives. One unit of 10 can be on 1 objective.
What's the threshold for blast?
10 guys. Six guys.
That's what I thought. Then, six, yeah.
Yeah.
Six and then 11.
So I thought 10 Dire Avengers was the logical step for Eldar players. You know, you take five Dire Avengers is the logical step for Eldar players. You just, you know, Falcon, 5 Dire Avengers. Wave Serpent, 2 into 5 Dire Avengers. Couple in whatever. Jump them around, dump them out, move and advance them. You still get to shoot because you're Eldar. And yeah, you could be a lot of places. You could be flexible and malleable. 13 points per model. That stings, man.
I think it's difficult for the troop section and the craft worlds right now. I mean, Rangers 15 points. I feel like that's a big increase.
What were they before? They were 12 points. That's 3 points per model. And I'm not even sure if they pay for their sniper rifles. Because admittedly, I don't even know what they're called. So if I was to look, I'd be like,
I think they're called Eldar sniper rifles.
Ranger long rifle.
That's it. Yeah.
There you go.
I knew they were very easy to pick out. Yeah.
That's the good thing about Eldar. You know, what do Dark Reapers use? Ah, a Reaper launcher. Well, there you go. Nice. what's the fusion guys? Oh, they use the fusion gun. Cool. Fire spike, whatever. But yeah, it seems like it's a bit rough. Where's the Guardians at? What have they got? So Guardians up 2 points for model as well. So 10 points for a Guardian. Even a Guardian is 1 point more than a Scion. Now, we're comparing apples and oranges here, admittedly. These are two different factions that operate in completely different ways on the battlefield. But yeah, I mean, is this just them rounding out to like a round number? Is there a troops choice out there that isn't a factor of 5? Oh, sorry, I just pointed one out. Dire Avengers 13 points. Ignore me.
Look, there's a lot to process here. We are unpacking. Well, I guess the things to really focus on is that I was just thinking like, well, you know, we have plenty of detachments that you don't need to take any troops for. So maybe if you're one of those factions that they got the big hit on the troops, you don't find them as valuable. You may want to take some other things, but those other detachments don't give you your CP refund for taking the Warlord. That is a command benefit of certain detachments.
There you go. So you still want a battalion, most likely. But maybe it's a patrol now for Eldar. Maybe the Eldar wants to build into a patrol. Have 2 fast attacks being, you know, shining spears or whatnot. 2 heavy supports being spinners or fire prisms. Yeah, maybe there is more of a patrol-based army there. We'll see. But
the elite slots and then the dedicated transport. See, wave serpents are still good. Wave serpents, I guess I'm saying they're still good, but, you know, without looking at the points, 130 points per model seems... I mean, without war gear, that seems about, at least not too far off from where they were.
It's a 10-point increase on what they were. They were 120 without war gear. And look, a lot of the war gear has actually gone down. Like a shuriken cannon is still at 10 points. Shuriken catapult's still at 0 points. Twin shuriken cannon has gone up 3 points. And twin shuriken catapult has gone down 2 points. So if you're taking it with all the shuriken loadout, it's kind of gone up 10 points. Maybe
that's not bad. So
that's not bad at all.
What I'm saying is that you could eat up the points with those things in your patrol detachment and not be necessarily shackled with very expensive Dire Avengers and Guardians.
So one thing, Dire Avengers are 13 points per model. They used to pay 3 points for their Avenger Shuriken Cannon, which was 3 points, now it's 0. So they're 10, essentially, they're still 13 points per model, undeniably, but they've only gone up 2 points per model from what they were. So... I mean, that feels a little better. No, that knowledge feels a little better, but still, like.
Well, I mean, I just don't know that they have the best function for their. I mean, again, maybe not. I mean, I guess what I'm thinking about is their toughness, their save, their weapon profile, and then those points in ninth. It's made me question whether or not that's a valuable choice.
Well, the thing is, you're going to have to take some of them, but I think there's just this line now where you just won't overinvest.
Hey, Storm Guardians are 9 points.
Watch out, man. Watch out. They're going to take the world by storm, everybody, because it's in the name. So what's 13 times 5? 65 points for 5 of them. Yeah, you're going to have to. I feel like you're going to have to. The game revolves around holding objectives so much. You're just going to have to take them, I think.
Yeah, no, yeah. You're right. Something's got to be taken. You know, whether or not
some, you have to have
something's going
to
do that, right?
Some obstacle has to be. I can't see people taking lists that are going to do well competitively, and this is purely competitively, that don't have obstacle, which I like. I think if you want to be a well-rounded player, a well-rounded general, you got to take some obstacle.
Having some power in that five-person troop, I mean, this is at least going to be early days. It's going to be multiple units. Like we may talk about this in an upcoming segment, but... You could still have maybe 120 boys, but they're going to be in 10 units or 12 units, 10.
Yeah. Yep. And maybe chuck a couple in trucks because trucks are cool. All right. It's red. We both know what time it is. It's the Paul Pandering time. Tell us about Blood Angels.
Oh, well, I'm sad to report that the Sanguinary Guard have gotten a little bit of an uptick. And maybe that's why I'm salty about some of these changes and how I just don't agree with some of the rules changes. Sanguinary Guard, the things that you would build the army around, at least in the way it went, have gotten a bit of an upswing. I mean, there's something like 34 points a model. Yep. Space Marine Scouts have gotten a bit of an upswing. It's an interesting time. But I can tell you what is cool and remaining cool is that they still get power in the character models. And the character models, if you want to play like Hero Hammers type Blood Angels, I don't think there's ever been, well, I should say 5th edition was really strong with that. That was the first edition that Mephiston was an independent character but couldn't join anybody.
Yeah, and he had his strength 10 instant death force thing and could go 20 inches in a turn. And
an independent character that could join. He was a monster on a
he was 20, an infantry monster base. Model. Yeah. Was awesome.
Yeah. And his stats play, I took him every game because it was amazing. But we're back to that. So we're back to where I think those you're going to be able to utilize the strength of some of those character models in the Blood Angel army. And I know not everyone likes to play that way because they want to construct and build their own heroes. And I get that too. But it's in an addition to where it's going to be difficult to get those really impactful smash captain charges off.
And well, the thing is, like, you're not going to be able to charge everything within 12. Kill one thing, pile in, consolidate into another one, and kill that one as well. And that's where it's going to become a bit difficult because you get the amount of, firstly, the amount of characters you have access to has been limited because you can no longer take a battalion and two supreme commands and just have like 9 characters. that's been reined in a little bit, but yet I feel like because you've got more, you're generally going to have more CP to plug into these dudes. You can make them do more, but the onus is on you as the player to get the most out of them. You can't just pay CP and they're just going to do stuff for you. Yeah. Like,
but see, Blood Angels also have, they've got some characters in the elite slot.
Yes. Are we talking like the Ancients and the whatnot?
Dreadnoughts and you know,
Stuff, of course.
Yeah, stuff that you can get some extra use out. And the Ancients, the Sanguinary Novitiate, those types of things, you can get some extra, the punch of that, things that are vehicles for your stratagems in that slot. And again, I think we're going to see some, I mean, it may be, you may see fewer models on the table from BA, but they're all going to be a little bit like landmines, like ticking time bombs.
I only have one question though. I only have one question. Are Baal Predators good? Please tell me they're good.
I can't get behind them yet. Look, I have not played them yet. I have not played a Baal Predator, but I want them to be good. And maybe that's where we'll start to see some, where you want that forward pressure and you can get that forward pressure. But I think we're still going to find better choices in the things like the Furioso Dreadnoughts. And you're still going to take 20 Sanguinary Guard. You may not take 30 anymore, but you're still taking 20.
Well, I see. I like the idea of, like, do you guys know the concept of MMU? You know, we have MSU. Do you know MMU? Multiple medium-sized units.
Okay.
I've been talking about this with a couple of other mates, and we're thinking, like, if you can get a unit, let's say, Bulgrin-esque, Centurion-esque, Aggressor-esque, Sanguinary Guard-esque, and you can efficiently run medium units of them now. Like, if you don't need 10 mans, you don't want, but 5 mans are too small, 10 mans are too big now. If you can run like 7 or 8 man Sanguinary Guards, 2 or 3 of those units, I feel like that's might be where the money is for them, because you can still get so much work out of that unit. You can still layer so many buffs on it, but it doesn't cop the worst parts of the meta changes. And I feel like it could be still placed in a sweet spot.
Yeah, I can see that, ringing out your points, like kind of assuming that you're only going to get to the combat with this many anyway.
Yeah, exactly right. So, e.g., like, I mean, Death Company, if you had a max size unit of Death Company, I've made this analogy before, or max size units of Orcs, you know, you don't need 30 boys to connect with that scout squad to kill the scout squad, you know?
And with the half-inch engagement range.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you see, people are complaining about that. It's like, when did you ever need 30 Orc boys to actually hit to kill something that wasn't Gilliman? Like, you know? It wasn't that big a deal.
That's fair. And I made a bad point there about having only so many get there, because you're going to need that more booty to get there to wheel you down to 8. But I think it may be a better one to point out that it is, we have a half inch like base range. Yeah. It used to be an inch. So fewer of them, even when you do get there, may be able to swing, especially when they're on the 32 millimeter bases.
Mm. So theoretically with Sanguinary Guard, how many, like with the right loadouts, you only need like 4 Sanguinary Guard to kill most things in the game with the right buffs, with the right loadouts. Like, realistically.
And with the stratagem that you got some extra CPs to pay now, that where your flattens out your damage to two.
Exactly.
No,
so, e.g., you slaughter intercessors. Like, if you need to clear objectives and then hold them, like with two up save dudes, while you're waiting for the scouts in the back to catch up, because you couldn't put them on the front or else they'd be the ones copying the Sanguinary Guard from your opponent, etc. I feel like there's a lot of use there. Like, a small, we don't want these. I feel like 8th edition, even though it wasn't what 7th edition was Death Star-wise, we still almost got there by the end because the game was polarized by these big units that you either couldn't handle or they just held the board and you couldn't get it back, e.g. Riptides and Drones. They weren't a unit, but they functioned like one. Centurions, they weren't, you know, two units of Centurions. They weren't one Death Star, but they functioned like one. Like, they polarized the game and made it so you couldn't contend unless you met certain really restrictive criteria that you almost had to build a whole army to get into. I feel like the medium-sized ones of that, medium-sized versions of those, things that don't overly polarize the game in and of themselves, but still give you the same feel and power and ability to dictate the terms of the game, I think they'll see a lot of play. I mean, I've been talking about chucking units, like three-man units of Bulgren in Chimeras and just like ramming them at people just because they're freaking annoying. And that kind of stuff, it seems like it's something Blood Angels can do probably better than most.
Do Ogryn still need like a character model to get in a Chimera with them?
No, they don't. That was a long time ago, Paul. Jeez.
They were afraid of the dark. They didn't want to get it.
I love those rules, though. Those rules are funny.
I'm just glad I didn't imagine it. That could easily be something that I just...
It was a dream. Paul dreamt he was an ogre and he was afraid of the dark. And he was asking his friend Commissar to get into the Chimera with him. That's hilarious. Someone make a meme of that. Put it on a t-shirt.
I think I want to play with the Ball Predator, of course, just to give it a shot. But again, these... Maybe I'm just conditioned to think it's not going to be amazing.
So let's just, you guys keep talking. I'm just going to price it up quickly. It's an incendium cannon on the top, for the flamer. And then it's just a twin auto cannon for the, assault cannon. Cool. I'll price it up.
You guys... Or you can have flamers, heavy flamers on the side, incendium cannon for the turret, or assault cannons.
Assume it's all flamers. Go all flamers.
All right. I'll do both. You guys keep chatting. I'll price this up.
Yeah. So to his point, the MMU deal, it kind of sounds a lot like Adam was describing what I had throughout last edition with 8-man squads of Khorne Berserkers, right? Doesn't that sound like what he was describing?
It does. Look at that. You're ahead of your time.
Well, I can tell you that fortunately, looking at some of the increases on them, it's not, I think largely in the Chaos Space Marine realm, I think, and it, this does, so I was looking at my LVO list. My LVO list, adding it all up, went up 307 points from what it was at. And I know that seems like a lot. And that's also I haven't seen the increase to the Forge World items. So like my Dreadclaw drop pods, I don't know what the increase is to those yet. But so I know 307 sounds like a lot, right? but Berserkers didn't go out the window necessarily. Khorne Berserkers went up by 2 points. And so they went from 16. So I'm running them exclusively with chain swords and chain axes, right? Because I don't need really ranged weapons, apparently. And so that was, went from 16 points to 18 points. That's really not too bad. I don't think I'm majorly. I was honestly concerned with the last chapter approved that I was going to go up points more than that. So I'm not too far out of the boat with that. No, where we saw the major point increases were Disco Lords. And Disco Lords went from the Lord Discordant went from 150 points to 180 points. That's 30 point increase. Pretty rough.
Yeah, it's a little rough, but I mean, they can do a lot of damage.
They can do a lot. To be fair, like I guess I was surprised that they didn't go up with the last chapter approved either. Really, I was surprised that Demon Princes came down in the last chapter approved, and they too went up. Demon Prince with Wings went from 155 to 185. So another 30 point increase. So that's kind of where
you have warp time.
That's right. That's right.
I'm just kidding. You still need wings.
And warp time. Wings help out a lot with the terrain and everything. But yeah, so that's where I saw a lot of my major point increases there was with that. So I guess I can't go too crazy. I don't think it's all doom and gloom with it. I do agree. With 8-man squads, though, you kind of put yourself. We talk about the MMU that Adam brings up. It kind of puts yourself on a weird angle between blast weapons and morale tests. And so that's kind of something to that threshold that I don't know if we've felt the full impact of it one way or the other.
Look, I know we're getting about to get the hot take on the Ball Predator points. Like a Furioso Dreadnought is about 115, 110 points. Like, doesn't that just sound good?
It does. I'm trying to look up your Death Company Dreadnought.
So I do have the points for the Baals racked up. So the Baal Pred with all the shooty, so that's the two heavy bolters and the assault cannon, has gone up 16 points to 170. Admittedly, all those guns can now shoot into combat. Like, you guys were right, the flamer option has gone down 3 points. Was 133, it's now 130 squared off with the incendium cannon, two heavy flamers. I can't help but think that might have some oomph to it. I'm not sure if it's great, but I can say that that's not bad. Like, what is that? What's the profile in incendium cannon? Is it the same as the Hellhound, I think, or is it two damage?
Strength 6, like neg 1 or 2 AP or something?
I felt like it was similar to the Hellhound one, which is 2d6, strength 6, minus 1, 1 damage. And so, yeah, I don't mind that, guys. Like, too heavy. So the difference from the Hellhound to the Baal Pred is the price of pretty much one heavy flamer. And that's literally the difference between the two, is one heavy flamer. So I'm keen. I think that's not bad. Whether that fits into the scope and the playability of that list, if that fits into the style of play you want, yeah, I like it. I like it a lot.
I'll try it out. Look, with a battalion, which I think is where you want to be, you have, you know, three heavy support choices to kind of play around with, and it's going to be hard to beat the eliminators. I think even with a point increase on those, the eliminators are really good for the function that they could perform. But, you know, a Baal Predator maybe I'll just be able to drive over there and dig things out and not care about the anti-line of sight stuff.
Yeah, I agree. I like it a lot.
But I am going to be putting on with the battalion detachment, you have 6 elite slots, and I feel like I'm going to be using every single one of those. But that's no different nice. Than now. But I am going to try these dreadnoughts. I think that the ability to come in from alternate table edges, the ability to run up behind some terrain, yeah, with a smaller profile thing, you know, while I'm buffing it, like I think you could make a conceivable army that you have 15 models on somewhere between 32 to 60 millimeter bases, just really putting a stranglehold on folks.
Yeah, I don't mind it at all, and it adds to a nice pressure play.
But we'll see. This is just kind of untested, sight unseen stuff. These are the things that jump out at me. It's like I want to play with this and see if I can make it work, and that's how I'm challenging some of my perceptions about what I would take right, you know, today in 8th edition. Well, I know this has been a very crunchy episode, so I appreciate everyone who's made it in here to the end. Hopefully that spot with Duncan is a bit of a palate cleanser. But we got more big stuff coming. Please leave us those 5-star reviews. Please like, share, and subscribe. Any other big standout units y'all want to mention briefly before we wrap up today?
I think Imperial Knights, on the whole, actually got away with it a little bit. I think they're actually not looking too bad. I mean, they're going to struggle with the format and a lot of playability, but I mean, they could have been dead in the water, and I think they're doing all right.
So mine isn't necessarily point related, but just as a caveat that, you know, the new facts, the FAQs dropped today, and I have to say I was kind of surprised and delighted. You know that awesome, almost like diorama piece that the Sisters of Battle have, the Triumph of St. Catherine?
Yep.
They dropped something in the FAQ that made it so that for the purpose of obscuring terrain, instead of it having 18 wounds, it counts as being a model with 9 wounds. So you can't see it through obscuring terrain.
Oh, wow. That's a big deal, isn't it?
Wow. We actually talked about that on the last show.
Oh,
we did.
Yeah. So I got to say, seeing that in the FAQ, that warmed my heart. I'm sorry. That didn't answer your question at all, Paul, but that was something I just needed to share.
No, that's an answer. It's good enough for me.
Yeah, I thought it was good.
Well, gentlemen, y'all have a great rest of y'all's night. We'll see you next week.
Y'all too. Take care.
Corner.